The topic we're supposed to do tonight, I understand, is the area of the holidays. Okay. Now, in order to know, in order to study the holidays, we have to, of course, take a look at the what the Torah's idea of a holiday is. Our own ideas are worthless. We always have to study what the Torah teaches us about the holidays. Now, let's begin with the question of how many places in the Torah do we have mention of the holidays? Okay, anybody have any ideas? When I say in the Torah, by the way, it only means in the five books of Moses. Because you know that there's an very important principle in Torah, and that is that after Moses, there is no such thing as a law given by God. Moses is the lawgiver, the only lawgiver. No prophet can ever add a single word to the Torah, to the laws. All the prophets did was they gave instruction. In other words, they chastised the people, they reprimanded them, they taught them ideas, philosophical ideas, they improved them, but nothing new. No new law was ever added or allowed to be added to Torah after Moses. That's why the Torah ends after the with the death of Moses. Okay, that's the end of a very specific framework in Torah, and that is God giving the laws to the people of Israel through Moses. Okay, I know the Bible critics wonder why the Bible ends after the Deuteronomy. They say it should end. A story usually ends after you come to the final objective of the story, which was to reach the land of Israel. So I think it's very strange that Joshua shouldn't be part of the Torah. And they give some ridiculous reasons as to why it isn't. One reason was it was simply too big to put on the scroll, which, of course, we understand is nonsense. The real reason is because the Torah ends after Deuteronomy because that's the end of a framework of halacha, which means that the only one that was entitled to give Torah law to the people of Israel was Moses. He was the only one. After him, no other prophet was able to do that. That's why when the Torah ends in the end of the end of Deuteronomy, it states that there never arose a man again as Moses. He was the only one that was on the level that was able to receive the law from God. Okay. Now, so therefore, when I ask how many places in the Torah, I don't mean in the Tanakh. I don't mean in the prophets also. I mean only in the five books because that's the only place where we ever derive any laws with regard to the holidays or anything else, but for that matter. Okay, so back to the question. We're going to study the holidays. We have to study the sources from Torah. Now, how many places does the Torah mention the holidays? Anybody have any idea?
Two?
No.
All right. Anyone else?
Where are those two, by the way?
All right, there's one in Exodus. Exodus 12, they're enumerated there, and then they're given again in Leviticus in relation to the priests, and then another one in Deuteronomy. We have three.
Okay. There are really three main ones, but then there are two more. Okay, so actually it's five. Now, if we take it in order, it goes as follows. The first time we have mention of the holidays is in the right after Sinai. It's let me just find it. Give me a second. It's 23, Exodus 23. Okay, in Exodus 23, it mentions that 23:14, you should have three festivals. Celebrate for me in a year. Okay, here it only mentions three. Interesting. It's repeated again, almost the same way, in Exodus 34. Okay? And Exodus 34 again. And we'll go into why the repetition. There's nothing extra in the Torah, and the repetition is there for a reason. But over here, in both of these cases, it's extremely brief. It doesn't really say too much about the festival. It just says that, that you should have these festivals. It mentions in 23:15, the festival of the unleavened bread. And then, and we'll get back to why, what the framework and what the purpose was of mentioning it over here. But over here, it's very brief, as I said. The main places where the festivals are mentioned are in three other places, okay? The first one we come across is in Leviticus, okay? Leviticus 23 begins right with 23. Okay, and it goes straight through, mentions all the festivals, and it mentions more than three. If you take a look, it mentions for instance, in Leviticus 23:24. Okay, in the seventh month, that's Rosh Hashanah, that's the month of Tishrei. Now, it's interesting, this is something which we should mention in passing, that in the Torah, when is the beginning of the year? You probably are familiar with the concept that the year begins with Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah literally means the beginning of the year. Now, that the beginning of the year is the month of Tishrei, okay? And that's the month that the Bible refers to, not as the first month, but as the seventh month. Okay, so that immediately requires some explanation. Again, if you take a look, the second place, let's just go through it, and we'll get back to that question in a moment. Again, if you take a look, the second place it mentions it is in Numbers. Okay, Numbers, you have it in Numbers 28. And over there it has Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month, a holiday you don't have mentioned before in Leviticus. But the rest are the same. So it goes through again. The first month. The first month means the month in which you have, of course, the holiday of Passover. All right. So we have twice over here so far. Now let's take a look again. There's one more place. The third place is in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy, you have again. A listing of the holidays, Deuteronomy 16, all right, 16:1. Make sure to keep the month, the spring month. You should make a Passover before God your God, because in the spring month, God took you out of Egypt at nighttime. And then it goes through the celebration of sacrificing the Paschal Lamb. So you have three essential places. As I mentioned, the first two we'll get back to in a moment. But the three places, the first two are just very brief, just mentions one word about each one, just extremely brief one sentence. But where the Torah elaborates on the festivals is only in these three places. One in Leviticus, one in Numbers, and once in Deuteronomy. Now the difference, now the question is, why do we have these three places? And as I said, everything in the Torah has a reason. It's not arbitrarily put together. There's a reason why we have it mentioned specifically and only in these three places. Okay? Let's see. The way to answer this question is with our usual method. Our method is not to try to think, and this is important, this is a method in Talmudic thinking in general, that we don't try to think of whys on our own. Why is this so? Why is that so? But what we try to do is to look at the information of the Torah and to define what is taking place, what exactly is happening in the Torah. So we convert, we always do that. As a matter of fact, in Talmudic thought, that is an essential principle. It's a type of thinking that in science really didn't develop till the time of Galileo. But in Torah, this is always the way we approach it. We don't go into why things are the way they are. We ask why, but when we approach it, we use a what approach. What does the Torah say? And if we study what the Torah says properly, then we will be able to answer our why question. So we answer a why question by converting it into a what question. Then if we're successful in our investigations, we come back and take a look and see if it answers the why. If it doesn't, then we weren't fully successful. If we are successful, it will also answer the why question. So the question of why the Torah has it split up into these three places. And as I said, we have to look for what exactly is taking place in these three places in order to understand the reason for this. Okay, now let's. It's unfortunate, you know, that this is not in person, because in person I think I'd be able to be more instructive. I mean, it's difficult on the phone to point out a lot of things, but let's try. The easiest way to do it is to, let's take a comparison, okay? Let's take numbers, okay? Numbers, for instance, where it brings in Passover and numbers. That's numbers 28:16, all right? So let's compare the text in numbers 28:16, and a little further also, and the text in Leviticus. And we'll see if there's any difference, okay? All right. We're at numbers already, so let's just take numbers. Take numbers first. Doesn't matter which one we take first. So our numbers states as follows, that on the first the first month, on the 14th day of the month, is Passover unto God. And, yes, and on the 15th day, there is a holiday celebration. For 7 days, you can only eat unleavened bread. Then it says, then it states on the first day, there's a holy calling, and we'll soon get to what that means. You shall not do any work. And then on 19 is where it begins. It says you should bring a sacrifice, and it tells you the sacrifice. And the sacrifice is two bullocks and one ram, 7 sheep, and then it goes. Then in 20, it tells you those things that always go with the sacrifices. Okay, let's take a look at Leviticus and compare. Okay? In Leviticus, you have... Oops, I have the wrong one. Yeah. In Leviticus, it says as follows. 23... Okay, 23 starts with the first of the 14th day of the month, Passover to God. Then it says also on the 15th. It's the holiday of the unleavened bread. 7 days you should eat unleavened bread. And then it says on the first day is a holy calling, and the first day of holy calling, right, and then it says, and on the seventh day in verse 8. Okay? Now, what is the difference essentially between these two sources? All right, anybody? A little difficult to pull it out, but the difference is that in Numbers, it mentions things that are not mentioned in Leviticus. That's the first obvious difference. And what is that? Those are the sacrifices that were brought in the temple. Okay, it doesn't mention anything about that. It doesn't mention what the sacrifices are in Leviticus. Okay? Now, Leviticus immediately mentions that the first day is a holy calling, and then it says in 23:8 that on the seventh day is a holy calling. And essentially, the essence of Leviticus is that you should not do any work, and it is a holy day. Now, let me, before we go any further, the word holy always disturbs me. Because the word holy does not have the connotation that the world in general gives to it. Holy in Torah does not mean some kind of mystical essence. Holy really means separate, designated. And this word, it's interesting, this word, Kodesh, is used even with regard to, for instance, when it states that, even with regard to things that are to be, are not virtuous. For instance, it states in Deuteronomy that you aren't permitted to grow the wheat and the vine together. And if you do, it says it becomes holy. Over there, it doesn't mean holy. It means that you're not permitted to eat it. So anything which is set aside is considered, anything which is set aside, that term Kodesh is the word. That term Kodesh comes into play. All right? So Kodesh does not mean whether it's for good or for bad. It doesn't matter. It means designated, set aside. That really is something different, set aside, different. It has nothing to do with whether it's virtuous or not. In our common parlance, the word holy implies something good, something holy. In Torah law, that is not the case. As a matter of fact, the Torah uses the term kiddesha, which means a prostitute. And it's from the same root, because it means that she's designated. It says you should not have a prostitute among Israel. And that word is kiddesha. It means that she's designated to for promiscuous sex. So the term is really designated. It doesn't have any connotation of good or bad. It means a designation. So in the when we say that the holiday is Kodesh, it means it has a special designation, set aside a special designation. We call that in the halacha, we call that kedushat hayom, the holiness of the day. But again, the word holiness is not correct. I would rather say the unique character of the day. That's what it really means. The day has a unique character, a unique character with regard to certain things. Now, let's get back to our original question. We have here the Numbers account, and then you have the account in Leviticus. The difference between the account in Numbers and the account in Leviticus is simple. The account in Leviticus, of course, comes first. The account in Leviticus merely speaks about the unique character of the day with regard to the prohibition of doing work. That is the entire chapter. And if you take a look, it follows through. The, for instance, let's take a look at Leviticus 23:24. All right. So over here it mentions Rosh Hashanah. On the seventh month, the first of the month. And it doesn't mention anything about which sacrifices to bring. Then, if you check again in Numbers, it mentions which sacrifices you should bring on Rosh Hashanah. Numbers 29:1-6. And every holiday which is mentioned is number in Numbers, if you read through the text of the Torah, you'll see it always lists essentially the sacrifices that were to be brought, and it mentions in detail all the sacrifices that were to be brought in the temple. Whereas in Leviticus, there is one exception, but essentially, it mentions not the sacrifices. For instance, take a look at Leviticus 23, all about the holiday of booths of Sukkos that we just celebrated. All right. But it says you should bring a sacrifice. It doesn't say what it is. But the essential thing is Leviticus 23:35. The first day is a holy calling, and you shouldn't do any work. That's the essential thing. The Torah does not tell us what the sacrifices are. It mentions the fact there are sacrifices, but essentially the purpose of Leviticus is to teach us one thing. That there is a unique character of the day with regard to the holidays, in that it is prohibited on those days to engage in certain types of creative activity. Okay? And we'll get back to that in a moment. Now, again, in Numbers, the essence of numbers, if you read through it, you'll see the essence of numbers is not the fact that you're prohibited to do work, but the fact that you must bring these specific sacrifices that are mentioned in numbers. That's the way the Torah expresses it. Now, this teaches us something. It teaches us that there are two separate categories of unique character with regard to the day. The concept of a holiday is a day that has unique character. What is the unique character of the day? The unique character of the day is expressed in two ways. One way is insofar as the prohibition, the abstention from certain creative activities, okay, a cessation of the creative activities. As I explained to you before, it means a cessation of technological man. That is really the purpose of that. That's the same thing is true on Sabbath. The same thing is true on the holidays. There is one formula, and that is that technological man stops. He can advance throughout the week, but when it comes to the Sabbath, that's it. He withdraws. And it is a day really designated not towards not to technological man, but intellectual and spiritual man. That's what the purpose of the holidays are, and the Sabbath. Okay, but we'll get a little further on. We'll discuss the difference between the two, because there is a big difference between Sabbath and the holidays. But let's get back to, there are a lot of points here. Let me just stick to the main questions I started with, and that is that, again, there are two unique character frameworks with regard to the holidays. One is insofar as the abstention from creative activity. That's in Leviticus. And the second one is with regard to the sacrifices that were brought in the temple. This also is a Kiddushat Hayom, a holiness of the day, a very special character that the day has, that in the temple, special sacrifices were brought on that day. So, as you know, the temple doesn't exist anymore. We've lost one quality of holiness of the day. And that is with regard to what took place in the temple. See, the temple is considered like a separate area and a separate framework for the temple, and that we don't have anymore. But Leviticus, we do have. In other words, the character of the day of abstention from work, that exists eternally. It doesn't matter whether we do have the temple, whether we don't have the temple, that always remains, because that's not dependent upon the temple. Okay. So now we've cleared up the difference between Leviticus, the account in Leviticus, and the account in Numbers. Two different facets to the day. One is insofar as the temple, the worship of God through the sacrifices that took place in the temple. The other is insofar as every individual's abstention from his creative work. And those are the two different ways in which the day is unique. It's unique insofar as the service and worship of the temple. It's unique insofar as each individual is concerned with regard to his abstention from creativity. Okay, a certain type, not intellectual creativity, it means technological, physical creativity. That's why, as I've mentioned before, the keeping of the Sabbath has nothing whatsoever to do with abstention from work, as people think. I mean, according to the Torah, you could even run a business on the Sabbath. It is really 39 specific activities that are considered the activities that reflect creative man. That's why lighting a fire is a creativity. After the Sabbath is over, I don't know if you've ever observed, but after the Sabbath is over, so there is the ceremony. It's not a ceremony. It's the statement that the Sabbath is over. And if you've ever seen this, you'll notice a fire is lit, and we make a blessing on the fire. Because fire is the mark of technological man. It's the first, most significant invention that man made in order to be able to sustain himself and to be productive. Fire is the symbol of man's creativity. The symbol of the first instance of human progress is reflected in fire. That's why we light the fire after the Sabbath is over, to indicate that now man is permitted to engage himself in his productivity, his creativity, his conquest of nature. Now, So now let's get back to the, we have two so far. Now let's take a look at Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy, we have, again, an account of the holidays, starting with Deuteronomy 16. And over here, there's one difference between the two previous ones. And that is, in the two previous ones, we have two additional holidays that are not mentioned in Deuteronomy. And that is the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the seventh month, and also Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Those are mentioned both in Leviticus and in Numbers. Not mentioned in Deuteronomy. It's omitted in Deuteronomy. Can anyone tell me why that is the case? And that's really the key as to what Deuteronomy is all about. Why Deuteronomy is different? Why it's repeated in Deuteronomy? It's a different concept. Does anyone have any idea about it? Do you wish perhaps to take a guess? I'll give you a clue. Deuteronomy 16:16. If you read that verse, you'll have the answer. Okay, the verse says, three times during the year all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which you will choose. And at that time there was no Jerusalem yet, but the Bible said that there will be a place which will be chosen. And here it mentions the three festivals. That's the festival of the unleavened bread, the festival of the weeks, and the festival of booths. All right? So the answer now is pretty clear, that Deuteronomy deals with a third facet, a third aspect of the holidays. And that is the going up, the pilgrimage to Jerusalem, to celebrate the holidays before God in Jerusalem. That does not take place on Rosh Hashanah, on the beginning of the year, nor does it take place on the Day of Atonement. That's why those two are omitted from Deuteronomy. So the Bible essentially breaks it up, the holidays, up into three separate areas. The first one is the unique character of the holiday with regard to every individual, every private individual, the abstention from creative work. The second is insofar as the temple is concerned, that's in Numbers. And in both of those cases, all the holidays are mentioned, not just the three, but the two other ones also, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Then, in Deuteronomy, it mentions only the three, because here it wants to teach you about a different aspect of the holidays, and that is that one is to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem and to spend time in the temple before God. So those are three different characteristics of the holidays, and that's why they're broken up into three different parts. Now, the question, of course, is why is the last one mentioned only is mentioned in Deuteronomy? And the reason for that is pretty clear, and that is that the Deuteronomy is the book that Moses gave to the people before he passed away, when they were about to be charged by Joshua to enter the land. So the laws in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is a very interesting book. It's the only book where Moses appears as a prophet, where he warns the people. And it's the only book where you don't have again and again, and God spoke to Moses saying, God spoke to Moses saying. The reason is because the commandments that were given to Moses by God, God always told Moses when to give those commandments, and they were given at different times. So he gave them. He said, tell the people this chapter at this time, and then it was written down, and it was taught and explained, and the oral law was taught to the what exactly the commandment meant. For instance, you should sit in booths. What is a booth? This was all explained, each thing as they went along. But Moses had also studied the entire Torah when he was on Mount Sinai with God during those 40-day episodes. So Moses really knew the entire Torah, but then God told him at different intervals to give the commandments, specific commandments, to the people at specific times. Now, the book of Deuteronomy, really, was it contains in it certain, some of the things are where Moses repeats certain commandments because of their prominence. Okay, it means, well, during that time, the pilgrimage took place from all parts of Israel, and they came to, every Jew that was capable of doing it was came to, came to the, there were certain exceptions, certain people that couldn't come, a person was sick or weak or different cases that they were exempted, but every normal male was capable, was obligated to come and bring the sacrifice in the temple. Getting back to Deuteronomy, the reason that there were certain commandments that were not given before, and Moses gave those in Deuteronomy, but all those are in some way related to going into the land, and some that have some connection with entering the land. And Moses realized that these commandments must be given to the people, and that it is God's will that they should be given right before they enter, because there's no comparison between a person being instructed immediately before he does something and a person being instructed years and years before. So therefore, certain things were necessary to be repeated again, and certain things that were not mentioned before were given at that time. Another reason is that the entire way of the concept that there's no such thing as giving instruction or reprimanding a person without knowledge and wisdom. And that's expressed in Proverbs, where it says that to know wisdom and instruction. So instruction, reprimanding, and trying to perfect a person, according to Torah ideas, you cannot really perfect a person unless you also give them new ideas. If you just tell them, berate them, you know, good at this, that really is not the Torah way. It's not really effective. The Torah believes in teaching a person, showing him through ideas how he's wrong, and involving them in ideas. And that's why a lot of those commandments were interspersed in Deuteronomy, where Moses warns the people and he exhorts them to keep the law, and he also teaches them the law as well. Because there's no such thing as exhortation without actual creative knowledge, being involved in the process of knowledge. Knowledge and exhortation have to go together. Just to give a person what we call musr, which means reprimanding, or the translation here is instruction, instruction is not really an accurate word, but it means to teach a person how to live. It's not enough to just reprimand them, but they must study and be involved in a creative process of unraveling ideas and thoughts. That's why Deuteronomy is interspersed with Moses warns the people, he exhorts the people, but he also teaches the people. He is the ultimate teacher. That really is the role of Moses, the teacher. So that's why, getting back to our original question, that's why in Deuteronomy you have only the three, because it's only speaking about the pilgrimage to the Jerusalem, or to the temple, and that was done only on those three festivals, not the other two. However, when it comes to Leviticus, where it's discussing the concept of abstention from work, that applies to not just the three, but to the other two as well, to the first day of the year and to the Day of Atonement as well, as you know. And then again, when it comes to the sacrifices in the temple, there were special sacrifices for those two as well. That's why those two are mentioned in Numbers and in Leviticus, but not mentioned in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy was before they were entering the land, so he spoke to them about the concept of going before God on these three festivals. Now, okay, so as again, I mean, it's not repetitious. It's three different concepts. The question, the first point we mentioned was that it does mention briefly, very briefly in Exodus, it mentions this idea, but it mentions it twice. And the reason for that is that in Exodus, well, we have an Exodus here, is the laws that the people received immediately after Sinai, after the Ten Commandments. That starts in Exodus, let me just get the number over here. It's actually Mishpatim in Hebrew, let's use the Raymond chapter. Chapter 21 is where it begins. It says, and these are the laws which you shall place before them. And interestingly enough, the first laws have to do with money, monetary matters. And the scholars arrive at this is really the sign of a righteous person. It's not simply that he keeps the commandments, but that he's honest and shows integrity in his financial matters. Then it gives a series of laws, essential laws, and, for instance, honoring parents, and then it discusses also, again, all the laws which have to do with monetary matters, with if a person's animal harms another individual, his responsibility insofar as not to steal, and if he does steal, what he has to do, and what if it damages, the whole system of torts, really, is explained in this area. Very, very sophisticated system. For instance, fire, if a person has a fire and accidentally the fire spreads, who's responsible? I mean, all these different laws which have to do with the monetary part of the Torah. And that's a good part of the Torah, by the way. It's a good part of the halacha. Extremely important and extremely exact in how it is to be carried out. Then the laws of lending money. Lending money to a person who is in need. And then it gets into... It gets into it towards the end. It gets into the keeping the Sabbath, and then it gets into the idea of going three times a year.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We got which book?
Oh, Exodus
12:14.
No, Exodus 23. Oh, well, you're asking me a question from Exodus.
Yeah,
12?
He wants Lawrence Ledford wants a 12 from Exodus 12, and verse what, Lawrence?
14.
Okay. And this day shall be unto you for a memorial, and you shall keep it a feast unto the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. Now, what's the question?
The question.
Come over here and do it through this, please.
Yeah.
Lawrence, he doesn't like to get up. But he's walking slowly this way.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I couldn't hear you. You began your over in, what was it, 23?
Right.
21, chapter 21.
Right.
Well, right here in 12, it tells this is for memorial, and because it's addressed to future generations,
That's right.
Wouldn't this be picked up as the first part on the instructions of the sacrificial lamb for Passover?
Okay. Yes, but the only thing is that it only mentions Passover there. It does not mention the other festivals. Okay, and I'm going to get back to that source. It's a very good source. I will get back to that source when we have to explain. I want to explain one point that I mentioned about the question of the months. So we'll get back to that source. It's a good source, an important source. But over there it only mentions Passover. And it mentions it in conjunction to the fact, really, if you look at Exodus 12, the main thing over there was the Passover that they kept in Egypt that first night. That is the main thing. But it states that this will be a model also for the future. But the essence of that chapter is the festival that was kept in Egypt on that night. That was before the nation even had accepted the Torah. So, but it does mention that this will be a memorial, and I'm going to get back to, I will get back to that also. That's a good point. But I was only discussing the areas in the Torah in the five books where it mentions all the festivals, or at least three of them, okay? So, getting back to the Exodus 23, the Nachmanides explains why this was given over here. And Nachmanides says that if you take a look at the verses, you'll see that it mentions the month of the spring in 23:15, and then in 23:16 it says, and the holiday in which you reap your harvest, the first harvest, and in the same verse it says, and the holiday where you reap your final harvest at the end of the year. So Nachmanides says that this all revolves around the field, around the agricultural situation. And the reason for that is that man should be aware that everything that occurs, you see, you have to understand, and this is extremely important, that the whole Torah is anti-idolatry. Now, all the practices in Egypt, and by all the idolatrous people in general, if you ever study any of their works, that most of them revolve around the agricultural. There are different agricultural rites and ceremonies and fertility ceremonies that were done. Now, the Torah wanted to make sure that man does not get involved in any of this kind of thing. So that's why when God took them out of Egypt and after the Ten Commandments, it was necessary right then and there to make this clear that their agricultural success must always be attributed only to God, the creator of heaven and earth, and to no one else. That's why it states that these festivals will take place on these agricultural periods. That's one reason why it takes place at that time. We'll see, that's not the only reason, but that is one benefit that is gained from the commandment. That's why it's the spring when things start to grow. It's the first harvest, which is the 5 weeks, the 7 week festival, I'm sorry. And then the festival of the booths, which is at the end of the year when the main harvest takes place. So Nachmanides points that out, that no doubt is the reason why they were given this immediately when they left Egypt after the Ten Commandments, was to make sure that energy is channeled towards God and not towards the primitive practices which are very attractive to man, as you see from all the nations that existed at that time. The reason why it's repeated again in a very similar way, again in Exodus, is because it was after the golden calf. Now, after the golden calf, what happened was there was a regression, you see, and there was a regression. The people got frightened. They suffered a primitive fright because they were too attached to the man Moses. He meant too much to them. And when they thought he lingered too long, they became fearful, and they immediately looked for their security in something physical to represent God, which was their golden calf that they made. Now, this was a regression back to the primitive state where man must have something physical in order to give him security in relationship to God. So once they had sinned with the golden calf and they regressed, so again they were given the commandments with regard to these times of the year that they should attribute their agricultural success only to the Creator. So that's why it was repeated again. Same idea, but it was repeated again after they failed with their sin with the golden calf. So that's the reason for that. Now let's get back to the question I was just mentioned here. That it is true that in the beginning of Exodus, not the beginning, well, relatively to Exodus 12, you have a mention of the commemoration. Now, let's take one of the questions that I raised before. The question was, why is it that the Torah, both in, if you take a look, you'll see both in Leviticus and in in Numbers, okay, refers to the first month as the month of Nisan. That's the spring month, and that's the month in which Passover takes place. Now, in both places, you know, practically always in the Torah, when it refers to it, it's always the first month is always the month of Nisan, where Passover took place, and the seventh month is the when we celebrate Rosh Hashanah. But in fact, the year always goes or begins. For instance, when you count the sabbatical year, the sabbatical year begins with Rosh Hashanah. It does not begin with Nisan, which is 6 months earlier. It begins with the seventh, what Torah calls the seventh month. Same thing with the Jubilee year. That is the beginning of the year. So the question is, why does the Torah call the first month, when actually the first month is what the Torah calls the seventh month? And why do we have these two types of counting? Why do we have these two types of counting? That's the question. Both are correct, but we have a system in which there are two systems of counting. And the answer, let's first go to the what, as we said before. The answer is that when we're speaking about the festivals, the first month is the month of Nisan. And when we're speaking about the year in which the Jubilee year or the year with a sabbatical year, there we're speaking in terms of what the Torah calls the seventh month, Tishrei, is the beginning of the year. That's what we call Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year. Why do we call this Rosh Hashanah? Maybe we should call Rosh Hashanah the month of Nisan. If a person wanted to stick literally to the text, that's the first month. The Torah says it's the first month. Yet nowhere in Judaism is the first month the month of Nisan. The first month, Rosh Hashanah, is the beginning of the year. Is what the Torah calls the seventh month. What is the reason for this discrepancy? Okay. The reason, I think, is that we have two different calendars. Now, you mentioned someone mentioned Exodus. Who wasn't mentioned? Exodus 12, right? Exodus 12. Now, the two calendars are as follows. Two calendars are, their time in a person's life has two meanings, okay? One meaning of time is it's a functional phenomena. It's functional. You have to have time. I mean, when do you make out your checks? When do you do business? So what day do I have this appointment? When am I going to see so-and-so? All these things are functional phenomena. So the calendar is important functionally to a human being. That's why people, that's why they get their calendars and little small ones that you could put your notes in and your appointment books and things like that. Because time for man is a functional concept. But there's another dimension of time. Time for man is not just functional for the present and the future, but it also is a reminiscence of the past. Time is important for man because man remembers time. He remembers that a certain event occurred at such and such a time. When a person thinks back over his life, he thinks of different events that occurred that were important to him in his life, that have meaning to him, and he thinks of the dates and the times in which those things occurred. This is not time functional because in terms of functionality, it's over. It happened already. What difference does it make? But this is something which is extremely important to man. So man really has two calendars. One calendar is a calendar of the events, the meaningful events of the past. Another calendar is a calendar of the present and the future that is functional. The Torah, interestingly enough, split up the two calendars, made two separate calendars. One calendar is what you might call the fiscal calendar. You see, that's the calendar with regard to the sabbatical year. Of course, in an agricultural society, the most important thing is to reap your harvest. And here, you aren't permitted to take anything from the field on the sabbatical year. That's a fiscal year. So the fiscal year begins on Rosh Hashanah. The functional year begins on Rosh Hashanah. That's why we say that we'll get back to this in a minute, but according to most of the scholars, the judgment takes place on Rosh Hashanah. That's Judgment Day. And the Judgment Day is the day in which God judges one for the year. What kind of time is that? That's time present and immediate future, functional time. God judges man in terms of how he will live, what type of a life he will have. That's something which is for man. This concerns man as he operates and functions. So that year, that calendar begins on Rosh Hashanah. But then there's another calendar. This calendar has to do with events that are not in the present, are not going to happen in the future. They're events from our memory traces, important events. And the Torah considers the past to be just as important as the present and the future. They all merge into one to create one human being. And the past that the Torah is concerned with is the important events that happened in the people's history. And that's why, as you mentioned before, and the answer is given in Exodus 12, because Exodus 12 concerns itself essentially with, as I mentioned before, with the sacrifice of the lamb that took place in Egypt. This was before it was a fixed law. It was before the Torah was given. It was for that night. Moses gave them that law for that night. It was a specific. It wasn't universal yet. But God told them that this will be something that you will commemorate forever. And if you take a look at Exodus 12, you'll see that it begins over there. It says the first month. It mentions the first month. That's in Exodus 12:1. Am I right? 12:1. 12:2. I'm sorry, 12:2. This month for you is the first of months. It is the first month for all the months of the year. Okay? What kind of, why? Because this was the first time that the concept of a month ever existed for the people of Israel. It was the first time they were marking time. And the time had halachic value. The time was, if you take a look, what does the time mean? It says, on the 10th day, the next verse states, speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying that on the 10th day of this month, they shall take a lamb, each one for his household. So the here was the 10th day. The reason why time was necessary was in order to have a framework in which to fulfill commandments. That was for their present. That was at that time, that was something, that was the first month that they had as a month. Now the Torah says, again, as you mentioned before, that this will be something for an everlasting for your generations. That's in 12:14. So the Torah was stating that this time for you was actually functionally the first month, but this will never be forgotten that this was the first month and that this was the first festival. This will be a part of the memory bank of events of the people. This is time past. It will become part of that calendar of the past. And that's why the Torah always, when it speaks of the festivals, always mentions the months as beginning. The first month is the month of Nisan, the month in which the Passover came. The Passover was given. But when it comes to now when the nation is set up, now they need a fiscal year. A fiscal year is something else. That's a functional year. That begins with Rosh Hashanah, with the beginning of the year. And the Torah separated these two calendars. It gave the people two different calendars. Why? The reason, I think, is very clear. Because the Torah wanted a person to recognize each calendar and its attributes, and each calendar and its own importance. If they were lumped together, a person would forget. He'd get involved in the functional. He'd forget about the past. So in order to make sure that people had this realization of the two different aspects of time, time, present, and future, and time in terms of past events, recounting past events, reliving past experiences, and realizing their importance and their influence on the history of the people. So the Torah established the calendar of the commemorative calendar, which really begins with the first month that they actually experienced when they went out of Egypt, and that was the month of Nisan, in which Passover falls. Okay? So that answers that question. Any questions? Does anybody have any questions?
Okay. I think everybody's in pretty good shape. And we're doing all right. So you may proceed.
How much more time do I have?
We got about 3.5 minutes.
3.5 minutes? Okay. All right. there is one, by the way, I mean, that's why, as I say again and again, without the oral system, there's no way to study Torah, because you see, the people, if you just look literally at Exodus, it says, this is the first month. The implication would be, well, this is only the first month. How could people call Rosh Hashanah the beginning of the year when the Torah calls it the seventh month? But that's where the concept of when Moses received the laws, he received their interpretation at Sinai as well. And the concept of the what the first month meant, the framework of that first month, was given to Moses at that time, that this is a framework of commemorative time, whereas the other framework is the framework of the beginning of the functional year. There is one exception that I mentioned before. I didn't explain it, but there's only one case where you have in Leviticus where you do have the mention of sacrifices, and that is in the Festival of Weeks. And over there, it mentions that it mentions the sacrifices in Leviticus 23:18. It says that you must bring the bread offering, and then it mentions also the seven lambs, and this is not what is mentioned in not the same sacrifice that are mentioned in Numbers, by the way. It's different. Now, why did the Torah single these sacrifices out and put them in Leviticus when the other sacrifices are really always placed in Numbers? That's true with regard to every other holiday except the Holiday of Weeks. Okay? So what I'll do is I'll give you an assignment to look into that and see what you can come up with, because I don't think I'll have time to put that on the tape. Okay?
Okay, that'll get us, and we'll begin right here on our next study.
Okay.